It is a Monday. That means we talk with Chicago Inno. We'll do that in just a couple of minutes. Randy Schaefer is a digital editor at the Chicago Tribune, and she'll stop by to talk about what's new on social media as well. You know, one of the things, there was a study out, I think it was from the Pew Research Center, that showed that even more of us now are getting our news from social media than from other outlets. Is that the case with you? There was a lot of pressure, of course, with fake news and all of that, but even given the fake news, it looks as if we still are turning to social media to find out what's going on in the world. In the studio this afternoon, Jim Dulkey from Chicago Inno, an old face, but he's got someone new, Catherine Davis, joining us as well. Catherine and Jim, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, Steve. Thanks.
All right. So Catherine is a little new, Jim, and I'm sure you've given her the primer about how difficult this program is and how hard-hitting all of the questions are.
And how mean the host is.
And how mean the host can be. Catherine, it's great to have you here. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I have been at Chicago Inno now for about a month. Getting to know the startup and tech scene here in Chicago, and got some cool stories to share with you guys today.
Yeah, and so really, I would imagine, how long did it take you to realize that if Jim Dulkey can do it, anyone can do it?
Maybe after the first time.
That's nice. She's been here a month and she's already better than Will, so it's going well.
Well, you know, that's not a big leap. Flanagan moved on to bigger and better. We're going to have Will come back on again sometime soon.
Yes, he is itching to call in from Charlotte at HQ.
All right, so let's talk about this Amazon story, this HQ2, where they announced a new headquarters. It's big. It's going to be big for any city that gets it, and Chicago right away started in on the fight.
Yeah, Chicago pretty much from the get-go said, yes, we are interested in this. Rahm has already been personally speaking with Bezos and the Amazon folks to try to land this thing in Chicago. And, you know, we saw sort of last week, everybody kind of started to crunch the numbers and figure out, based on the criteria that Amazon put together, like what cities are going to be in the running for this? Who is kind of like among the forefront of places where this could go? And Chicago, believe it or not, landed on almost all of those lists. NBC, Axios, CBS, even the Seattle Times, Amazon's hometown newspaper has Chicago on their short list of places. So, based on the business climate here, you wouldn't necessarily think that Chicago would be the ideal suitor for Amazon, but believe it or not, it actually fits a lot of the criteria that Amazon is looking for, and we know that the city is going to go after this really, really hard. Chicago and the state of Illinois would love to have an Amazon here in the state and in the city, bringing about 50,000 high-paying jobs. These aren't factory jobs. A lot of these are in tech engineers. These are 100,000.
Like some of these are like six-figure jobs by and large.
$100,000 average total annual compensation for these jobs, and so it's good. It's got the chance to really change the tech scene in Chicago.
So if you're a city and you're talking about 50,000 new jobs, by and large, high-paying jobs, I mean, even a city the size of Chicago, it could be transformative in many ways.
It could, and it really could change the face of the tech and startup scene around here. I mean, that's one of the main knocks on Chicago's sort of growing tech scene is it doesn't have the kind of like tech pillars, meaning like the massive hirers of tech jobs that you see in other cities, like the Dells in Austin and the Amazons and the Microsofts in Seattle. Chicago's, you know, big tech players, even like the Groupons and Grubhubs, aren't hiring in the numbers that a lot of these other tech players are. So really what happens is you have that with Amazon if they do end up coming here. It changes how you retain the college graduates. You'd imagine that way fewer University of Illinois engineers would flee to the coast and stay if they had an opportunity like Amazon. On the flip side of that, though, you could see actually some short-term negative effects in terms of startups in Chicago being able to hire talent because a lot of people are going to be trying to take those jobs at Amazon. So you actually could see a bit of a downside in the short term, but in the long term, this is a total home run and it's something that Chicago would absolutely love.
Well, you know, everyone points to the fact that Amazon is building distribution centers. They just had those job fairs in the area not too long ago. So it looks as if we have the relationship already. But I would imagine there are other cities around the country that think they've got a pretty good fight, too.
Yeah. Some of those other cities like Austin and Texas, they could grab the new Amazon headquarters just because Amazon just bought Whole Foods, which is based there. Additionally, Washington, D.C. might also be a player because Bezos owns a home there, the CEO of Amazon. So
Why do they need to have this expansion at all?
Well, they are growing too fast for Seattle. The argument is that they add 50,000 more jobs to Seattle, and it's growing too fast for the city. So really what they are trying to do is expand their geological footprint, try to take some the pressure off Seattle. I mean, you kind of look at what's happening in the housing crisis in the valley, and you put too much strain, too much tech in an area can actually like really, really hurt the affordable housing and a lot of other aspects about city living. So what I think they want to do is they say, hey, we are really, really ready to grow. We're really ready to expand. We want to put another headquarters of equal value to Seattle, but we want to put it someplace else.
Any sort of timeline? Do we know when we might get some sort of an announcement here?
We're going to get an announcement. So the proposals are due in about a month, and then the announcement will be made in 2018.
You know, the other thing that strikes me about it, and then we'll move on, is Amazon and Illinois haven't had a great relationship, right? There was the fight over taxes, and Amazon would have to have taxes if they needed a brick and mortar store in Illinois, and there was that sort of fight behind them. Do you think there are sort of any negative repercussions from that relationship that might hurt Chicago and Illinois?
It could. I mean, there's so many variables to this that we'll see. I mean, the Chicago also has the cloud tax, right? So that was like, possibly one negative that could affect Amazon landing here. There are analysts that have said, Chicago isn't going to be able to offer the kind of tax incentives that other places are. And an analyst told CBS, an article that I was reading the other day, that, just because tax incentives aren't going to be the number one reason that Amazon chooses a place, mm-hmm. it won't be the determining variable. It will be one of the variables, but it's not going to make the wrong place the right place. So Chicago, even if it doesn't offer the kind of incentives that another city around the U.S. can, it's still going to be a major player to land Amazon.
And Chicago's got the cloud, that beautiful sculpture. I don't think any other cities have that, right? So we've got that going for us.
Oh, yeah.
Catherine, you wrote a story, and I don't even know how to pronounce this bar, this health food bar, RX Bar. Is that the correct way to say it?
Yeah, RX Bar. It's made by local startup Chicago Bar Company. They specialize in making like a protein bar that's really transparent about the ingredients inside of it. So they list the ingredients right on the wrapper, and there's no added sugar, gluten, soy, or dairy products. They were founded in 2013, and they're estimated to make more than $20 million in 2017. So reported by the Wall Street Journal is that they're they're exploring a sale with a Chicago-based investment bank.
And this is fast, right? I mean, they were, at their beginning, I think, only available at CrossFit gyms. Now they're in Walgreens and elsewhere, and it looks like the sky's the limit.
Yeah, absolutely. They're growing really fast. They are the third best-selling nutrition bar on Amazon, and they also have an Amazon Dash button, so it seems like people are buying these, eating these.
I think that's the thing. If you get a Dash button, you're golden. And you can buy them maybe soon in an Uber car near you.
Yeah, absolutely. In Cargo, which is actually a New York-based startup, but they recently expanded to Chicago, they make these like plastic boxes that you can strap to a console in a ride-sharing car. So they work with Uber and Lyft drivers, and riders can have access to snacks, phone chargers, beauty products, and also some free samples. Not everything in the box is for sale. Some of it's free.
So the idea is this company partners individually with the Uber drivers, not with Uber, but with individual drivers or Lyft drivers. They sell stuff out of their car, and then they get half the cash.
Yep, absolutely.
Are they new? Are they in Chicago now, or just talking about coming to Chicago?
They are in Chicago now. I actually saw one in Uber last week.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
And then elsewhere, they're in Boston?
Yep, also in Boston, and looking to expand beyond that as well.
Now, I would think if I'm Uber that this is a revenue sort of stream that they're giving up, that they might want to control this themselves. Any pressure that way?
I think maybe from Uber or Lyft side of it, but Cargo, I think they want to, for them to make the most money, it makes sense for them to partner with the individual drivers.
You heard at the top of the news that there are several states now suing the federal government over these cafe standards, the gas limits and the targets coming up for the auto industry. David Jennings had that in the newscast coming up in the second half hour of the program. We'll talk to Lauren Fix. She's known as the car coach and automotive expert, and we'll talk to her about all of that. But right now in the studio, talking about Chicago, Inno, Jim Dulkey and Catherine Davis are here. Catherine is relatively new to Chicago. I know, certainly new to the program, so it's great to have you here, Catherine.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sometimes I see these new companies, these startups, and I think, wow, what a great idea, something that's never existed, something that technology can really help create. And then other times I see things and I think, well, hasn't this been around forever? And I don't mean to put down well-tended, but that was kind of my reaction there. This is a company that wants to help you with houseplants in your apartment. I'm not sure, though, where they're breaking new ground. Tell me about them.
Yeah, so Well-Tended is a new startup launched in February. It was founded by a recent graduate from Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. And they specialize in matching people with potted plants and delivering to them directly. You know, people can go to their local florist or the Home Depot around the corner and buy plants. So you might be like, what's new about this? But they're really trying to improve the customer experience by, you know, when you go to their website, you can either shop for plants right away if you know what you're looking for, or you can take a quiz. So that's sort of that customer experience aspect, trying to help match you with the perfect plant.
Yeah, so and I think part of that too is that it asks you questions about the environment that you have and how much time you're willing to invest in, like, taking care of a plant. So if you want to just leave it in the corner and not do anything about it, this is the kind of plant for you. If you've got an apartment with very limited sunlight, maybe this is the kind of plant for you. So I think it's a little bit more of an educational element too, not just like, here are some plants to buy online.
You know, and I suppose that's true. It's interactive in that you're going to learn a little bit more about the plants you're purchasing or purchasing rather than just going to a big box store and bringing something home and not really knowing how to care for it.
Exactly. And the founder should know she has about 70 to 80 plants in her Lincoln Park townhouse. So I think she's very aware of the plant industry and what works inside.
Well, Jim, I think speaking as a former single guy, I can speak for you as well. Better plants than stuffed animals.
I think that's fair.
Let's talk about John Deere. You know, more and more it looks as if they are moving toward investing in technology. And they just made a pretty big purchase, $305 million for this Blue River technology. Who is that and why are they good for deer?
Yeah, basically, John Deere has bought this California-based startup, Blue River Technology, for $305 million, and they bring machine learning to agricultural spraying equipment. That's kind of a mouthful, but basically what they do is they use sort of machine learning technology to help these herbicide machines spray more accurately, really targeting on only spraying the weeds, so you're using a lot less chemicals on all of your plants. So basically, they are a smarter herbicide spraying startup, and an interesting thing about them, they're a 60-person team out in California. John Deere is going to keep the whole team. They're not absorbing them. They want to basically use that technology that they're working on to bring it into John Deere and sort of apply it to some of their machines. And another detail about Blue River Technologies is that they've raised about $30 million since launching back in 2011 from two Stanford grads. They actually count the Alphabet chairman, the Google head, Eric Schmidt's Innovation Endeavors VC among its investors.
So it's good for the farmers because they're spending less time or less money on their product, and it's good for the earth because they're putting less or fewer chemicals into the ground, which is good for the farmers too. That's certainly what they're after as well.
Exactly. Good for the environment, good for business. It's just, you know, really smart sort of niche technology that John Deere found and said, hey, wow, we can really apply this to what we're doing.
Yeah, and so that's good. And so Deere, I would imagine, are they leading when it comes to ag companies doing this? Or I would, old world sort of agriculture companies are updating and they're just sort of following that lead.
Yeah, I mean, I think they publicly traded Deere. I mean, they definitely feel like they're a leader in what they're doing here. And it's interesting to kind of see how these sort of like, decades old industry monster players are sort of scooping up the tech startups and doing everything they can. I mean, they actually sort of compared this acquisition Deere did to Navcom, which it bought in 1999, which established Deere as a leader in GPS tech for agriculture. So they think it's that sort of level of a significant investment.
That's Jim Dahlke, Catherine Davis, both of Chicago Inno. Where can people read more information about these stories?
Check us out on chicagoinno.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily newsletter.
Excellent. Catherine, will you come back again? Did we do okay?
Yeah, I'll be back next week.
Okay, two in a row. All right, thanks, guys. It's good to see you. We'll see you again next Monday.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks.
Randy Schaefer will be on a little bit later in the program. You know, she's a digital editor for the Chicago Tribune, and she brings by some stories about what's going on in social media. One of the things that struck me was an essay from someone who has decided, you know, we tell everything. We keep no secrets anymore. We post on Instagram about everything we do. And so this woman wrote an essay about the value of keeping a secret, nothing that's you wouldn't want people to know, but rather than sharing all the time, just maybe keeping something to yourself. Sounds kind of old world. There's value to it, and we'll talk to Randy Schaefer about that. We started the program, though, with David Jennings in the newsroom talking about this lawsuit that five states have filed now against the Trump administration over the CAFE standards. The rules were supposed to say that by 2025, this was an Obama-era rule, car mileage averages were supposed to be about 54.5 miles per gallon. The Trump administration announced early on that perhaps they were going to relax that or at least relook at it. And so today we've got this lawsuit. To help us understand it all, Lauren Fix is on a phone line. She's known as the car coach and automotive expert. Lauren, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Well, thank you for having me. Yeah, this is a very interesting situation that we kind of predicted once we knew that President Trump was going to be in office. And actually, this impacts a lot of things, not just manufacturers, but consumers.
Right. So tell me, let's back up and give me the big picture here, what these CAFE standards are and why it is that the Obama administration and many others, many in the science world, wanted the levels raised.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, corporate average fuel economy is what CAFE stands for. In other words, each manufacturer has to produce a certain number of, on average, that's half-ton trucks all the way down to regular cars and hybrids and whatever is combined. They have to currently, as of today, meet the corporate average fuel economy of 34.5 miles to the gallon. Now, why did that happen was back, we're going all the way back to the oil embargo days when OPEC was controlling everything. That was when we said, wait a minute, we're going to have to do something to offset this. And we didn't want to be in a gas shortage situation again like we had during Jimmy Carter. So the government decided to put this corporate average fuel economy and they slowly were increasing it. So now they're saying by 2020, which is just around the corner, we're looking at 54.5 miles to the gallon. Now on the surface, you think, that's great. My car's going to get 54 miles a gallon.
Right.
We're going to have all the great things. Well, there's a price to pay for this in a lot of different ways, and I think that's why all this happened. First off, for consumers, that means cars are more expensive. And literally, just before this radio interview, I was talking to someone about why she was looking at a particular vehicle, and she said, I can't understand why this particular SUV is so much more expensive in 3 years than it was when I bought it 3 years ago. And I said, that's because all the government regulations. Somebody's going to pay for the technology. Someone's going to pay for the lightweighting of these vehicles. And someone's going to pay for all the fees and fines that could naturally be assessed to any manufacturer. I mean, think about it. That's why everybody's making hybrid vehicles.
So, Lauren, what I read from you is that you aren't necessarily a big fan of these, that the car companies, as you said, they have to purchase or make a certain number of cars that meet this limit, but not all of their cars. So they're just kind of making cars to boost their standard and then selling the gas guzzlers at a reduced rate, and it's probably not helping us all that much anyway.
Well, in the end, what ends up happening is every manufacturer has to produce a hybrid vehicle because the state of California seems to have the power over the federal government right now. They're saying if you want to sell.
Now, since you said that, California's kind of operating on its own, isn't it?
Right. And, of course, they make the regulations for their state, and every other state seems to follow. They feel that California feels that they're making the regulations for the country.
Okay.
So right now they're saying if you produce more than 2,500 cars that are sold in the state of California, you must sell a hybrid. However, every manufacturer takes a loss on every plug-in hybrid or hybrid vehicle they sell. Who's paying that price? You're going to pay that price in the cost of a new vehicle. And so then you start thinking about, oh, wait a minute, they're lightweighting a car that doesn't make it as safe. True. That's another factor to consider. So maybe in the end you think you're getting better fuel economy, but doesn't that offset it because of the increased price of cars? Now, not everybody buys new cars. I get that. But in order for it to make 54.5, there's going to be a cost. There is one other factor to consider. All the manufacturers have done their product planning for way more than a year or two out.
Right.
So we're talking 2018 is coming to dealer. 2020, they've already made the plan for the better fuel economy cars.
Well, okay, but the car companies, they could make cars that are much, much cheaper. They could, you know, make them less safe. They can make them less fuel efficient. They would be cheaper, but they might not be better for us as a people, as a world. And maybe we need to pay a little bit more if it means reductions in pollution. Maybe the cost of the car shouldn't be the only standard. I mean, how do you respond to that?
Well, I hear you talking. I think that safety is an important factor. I mean, we've already still have deaths on the roadway, and I don't think you're ever going to get to zero because there's human error involved. And we won't even talk about the autonomous car subject because that's so far down the pike anyhow, and that's probably for another conversation. But as far as hybrid cars, people that buy them don't necessarily like them. They buy them because they meet certain fuel efficiency standards, or they want to be green, and if you realize, you look at these hybrid vehicles, you think, oh, I'm going to buy myself a plug-in hybrid. It's the most fuel-efficient vehicle I can get, and I'm being greener for the environment. But you're actually not, because these batteries have rare earth minerals in them, including cobalt, lithium, and mercury, which we do not strip mine here in the U.S. They strip mine them in the Congo and in China. And now who's in charge of our energy is not going to be OPEC any longer. It's going to be China and the Congo, because they're strip mining using children. They don't care. The UN has already regulated 80 deaths. They've already registered that many that they're aware of children that are in these mines getting what they call cobalt lung, because they don't get any breathing material, any protection like we would do here in the U.S.
Okay, so I mean,
do that here in the U.S.
I respect your point of view because you know a lot more about it than I do. You just do. I'm not a student of it like you are. But it still seems to me that there's value in trying to reduce the amount of fossil fuels that we're using. And if an economic incentives are there to create people to maybe drive less or to use fuels more in a more smart way, there's value there, that the only sort of measure shouldn't be how much a car costs. Am I wrong in that?
I agree with you. It has nothing necessarily to do with the cost, but I think there's other factors to be considered. If we're looking at government regulations, for example, since you mentioned it, and that's a whole other subject again, but for example, a company like Tesla took $5.2 billion of our tax dollars, and he's using that to fund his company. Now, if that were going into schools and roads and bridges, that might be a different story. That might help do a lot of other things. And if we use that money for proper purposes, but instead, if there was no government incentive involved, but manufacturers said, listen, we can produce better fuel-efficient vehicles, which they can, and they are. They're doing it not just because they've already planned for it, but we have to actually look at the bigger picture on this, you know, the impact of all this. If there's no government subsidies involved and consumers actually wanted to buy these cars, then they would have to raise the price of a hybrid vehicle even more so in order to compensate for the fact that they're taking a loss on every vehicle. Nobody, no manufacturer can take a loss and make it up in volume.
Okay, I'm out of time. I'm out of time, Laura, but I want to get
subject. Yeah, we can keep going.
But I want to get to one other thing that I ran across with you, because you just mentioned, you know, autonomous cars. It's just too much to talk about. I saw an interview you were doing, and you talked about car owners who have now self-parking cars. That's kind of an autonomous function of a car. But those drivers, they don't use it because they're afraid of it.
Right, 95% of people that have it don't use it. And what's going to happen with autonomous cars? They better have steering wheels and pedals, because I'll tell you what, I'm not riding in an amusement ride. I can go to Disney.
We'll have you back with a lot more to talk about. Lauren Fix, the car coach. Great to talk to you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your time.
This Monday afternoon edition, Randy Schaefer is a digital news editor for the Chicago Tribune, and she's in the studio this afternoon. Randy, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, good to hear from you.
Okay, so, you know, I want to talk about where we get our news and the Pew study and all of that. But first, you gave me this really nice essay written by a woman named Jenny Avins about the fact that she lives in California, and she sort of does surfing at dawn. And rather than post it like everyone else, she just keeps it to herself, and it's sort of her own personal nugget. It's kind of weird to me that we're in this place now where we're withholding things to make them more special rather than sharing them. But it's kind of a reversal on the whole social media thing. And it just got me to wonder. I don't know if other people do that as well, but give me your thoughts on that essay.
Well, the first time I read it, I kind of wondered if you were secretly practicing tap dancing or something like that and not sharing it on social media.
I'm not going to tell you now, Randy.
No? I'll just have to start stalking the local tap dancing studios for a glimpse of Steve Bertrand, I guess.
Right. It's in my basement. You'll never find me.
But yeah, no, so this piece, like you said, by Jenny Avins, a QZ piece called The Unexpected Joy of Keeping Secrets from Social Media was really interesting. I like the part where Jenny said that she had gone to visit a friend and saw her friend's pregnant belly for the first time and was completely shocked because she hadn't seen it on social media. And the friend said, you know, your reaction is exactly why I didn't post it online.
It's kind of a nice thing, so we don't have to share everything. And when we don't, sometimes those things we don't share become even a little bit more dear. So that's kind of a cool thing. Check it out. But we are getting more. I'm surprised by this Pew study. It shows that more and more we're getting our news from social media. And this comes after a year where news from social media took a lot of hits with fake news and all of that. But this Pew study, let's see, the latest numbers, 67% of adults are getting at least some of their news on social media. 20% report doing it often. But I'm in that category. I mean, I get much of my news from social media, so I don't know if I should be surprised by the number, discouraged by the number, or just sort of expect that's the world that we live in.
I think that's just kind of the world that we live in now. You know, I'm the exact same as you, although the Pew study does say that the majority of American adults get their news from Facebook. I'm very much in the Twitter camp. I'm a huge fan of Twitter. So I thought that was a little surprising, although there are way more Facebook users than there are Twitter users. So maybe in retrospect, it's not that surprising.
You know, for example, when the show started, David Jennings did a story about the CAFE standards and these five states suing. So what did I do? I turned right to Twitter and did a Twitter search to try to find different news outlets that were doing reporting on it. That's how I get a lot of my news now.
Oh, absolutely. And I do the same. You know, if the CTA is not coming, I immediately turn to Twitter and search CTA or CTA down.
Right.
And I think a lot of people kind of share that mentality.
And so we shouldn't be worried about this factor? I mean, it's just sort of a measure, like how tall we are or how fat we are. It's just what we are now?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. And we've kind of talked about this whole fake news problem before, with a lot of the links showing up on social media being, you know, just plain fake news, not just onion satire, but straight up fake news. And that's going to be more and more of an issue with more and more people turning to social media for their sole source of news.
You know, I know Facebook has admitted that they took some ad money, or disclosed, I should say, took some ad money from fake news purveyors. But they haven't told us what those stories are yet, have they? I think it would help for us to know just exactly what stories we were being fooled by.
I think so, too. And I'm kind of hoping that Facebook will end up releasing some of that data to us. I think it'd be really interesting.
Is there pressure for them to do that?
I think there's a little bit of pressure, yeah.
All right, we'll see. Randy Schaefer writes about digital. She's a digital news editor at the Tribune. Thanks for coming by today.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.